This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour, an inside look at police unions, how they became so powerful.
They're only powerful because we allow them to be powerful politically.
And how they could help or hurt police reform.
The unions, they have to come on board. They don't want change, but we have to change with the times.
Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The U.S. sets a new record for daily coronavirus infections as hospitals in hotspots find themselves inundated with patients. A landmark decision. We examine the Supreme Court ruling that half of Oklahoma sits on Native American land and ask what it means for the future of the state. Then, Lebanon in crisis, a look inside the pivotal country as a pandemic lockdown and an economic crash spark unrest.
The Lebanese people, when they see there is no justice, the protesters will be obliged to use violence to take their rights back, and we go to the politicians' places and take our money back from them.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down this past week and the Trump administration's response to a rapidly expanding pandemic. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. More states are moving tonight to try to curb the surge of COVID-19. But for now, at least, infections keep reaching new levels with no end in sight. Lisa Desjardins begins our coverage.
Every day this week, in just about every state, caseloads of the coronavirus have been rising. The nation as a whole has logged record numbers in six of the last 10 days. Texas is one of the hardest hit states, with over 10,000 new cases of the virus yesterday, and the death toll surging past 100 per day. In Florida, patients are pouring into hospitals that once thought they had turned a page.
We felt good for a while. We were able to close down the COVID ICU. We had all the COVID patients in one floor. We felt like we had our handle on it. And then we had to open up a second floor and a third floor. Now we're into a fourth and fifth floor. And we don't see it getting any better.
In Orlando today, Governor Ron DeSantis again defended his decision to restart the economy in May.
There was really no justification to not move forward because of the low. And that continued all through May, continued in the early part of June. And then we've now seen more cases in transmission at the exact same time that the rest of the Sun Belt is.
But now more states are pivoting back to old containment measures. Mississippi's governor has now made face masks mandatory in 13 of the hardest hit counties. Michigan has toughened its mandate that businesses deny service to those without a mask. New Mexico is canceling contact sports at high schools this fall and banned indoor dining at restaurants. And Nevada ordered bars to close again starting tonight. Meanwhile, the American Academy of Pediatrics, plus two major teachers' unions and a school superintendents' organization, warned today against reopening schools this fall unless local experts approve. President Trump has threatened to cut off federal funds for schools that don't reopen and criticized CDC guidelines as too onerous. Last night, he played down the severity of the virus's new surge in a phone interview with Fox News.
Literally, in most cases, they automatically cure. They automatically get better.
The president also stepped up his criticism of Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's foremost infectious disease expert.
Dr. Fauci's a nice man, but he's made a lot of mistakes.
Fauci, in turn, told the Financial Times he has not briefed Mr. Trump for at least 2 months, and they last saw each other in early June. Around the world, Australia, looking to contain a new outbreak in Melbourne, announced limits on how many of its own citizens will be allowed to return home from overseas each week. And Britain, slowly emerging from its lockdown, lifted a 14-day quarantine requirement for arriving travelers. Those rules, however, remain in place for those from higher-risk countries, including the U.S. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
In the day's other news, President Trump made a trip to South Florida, even as COVID infections kept rising in the state, as you heard. But he postponed a campaign rally that had been scheduled for tomorrow in New Hampshire, citing the approach of Tropical Storm Fay to the region. Campaign officials had already acknowledged that it was not clear how many people would show up. That same tropical storm is racing up the eastern seaboard tonight. It made landfall earlier near Atlantic City, New Jersey, with winds of 60 miles an hour and pushed toward New York and New England. Along the way, it touched off flash floods in Newark and other towns in New Jersey and shut down beaches in Delaware. Utah has closed its state capitol building through Monday after protests over a fatal police shooting turned violent last night. The district attorney had ruled that two officers were legally justified in killing Bernardo Palacios Carbajal. He had a gun and was shot more than a dozen times as he tried to run away. His family condemned the finding. In Turkey, a court today allowed officials to convert the World Heritage Site, Hagia Sophia, in Istanbul, back to a mosque. It had been a Christian cathedral for 900 years, and then a mosque for 500 more, and then a museum since 1934. Today, crowds gathered to celebrate and to pray. Supporters of the decision said it's a long time coming for a majority Muslim Turkey.
Once upon a time, this was a place of worship for Christians. But with the conquest, it has become a symbol for us. It has become a symbol of the conquest. Therefore, we have been thinking for years that we should have the liberty to pray here.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hailed the decision. He has sought to bring Islam back into mainstream politics. The U.S. and much of the international community largely oppose the move. French officials now say that Notre Dame Cathedral will be rebuilt exactly as it was before last year's disastrous fire. That comes after President Emmanuel Macron had considered modern additions, with ideas ranging from a rooftop swimming pool to a glass spire. The 12th century Paris landmark went up in flames in April last year. Actual rebuilding work won't begin until next year. Back in this country, a federal judge in Indiana has delayed the first execution of a federal prison inmate in 17 years. Daniel Lee was set to die by lethal injection on Monday for three murders, but relatives of his victim said that they were afraid to attend because of rising coronavirus infections. And on Wall Street, investors shrugged off worries about the pandemic, at least for today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 369 points to close at 26,075. The Nasdaq rose 69 points, and the S&P 500 added 33. Still to come on the NewsHour, a Supreme Court win for Native Americans in Oklahoma and what it means. Lebanon faces financial freefall and political turmoil amid the pandemic. We hear from the front lines of healthcare in Houston as COVID-19 cases in Texas surge, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court reaffirmed Native American rights to millions of acres of land in eastern Oklahoma. The 5-4 opinion granted jurisdictional control to the Muscogee Nation. That decision extends to four neighboring tribal nations, which together make up more than half of the state. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the opinion stating that, quote, "Today we are asked whether the land that these treaties promised remains an Indian reservation for purposes of federal criminal law, because Congress has not said otherwise. We hold the government to its word." Here to talk about the significance of this decision is Allison Herrera. She's a reporter for KOSU Public Radio near Oklahoma City. Allison Herrera, welcome to the NewsHour, and I have to say I have a special interest in this case as someone who was born in Tulsa. But let's talk about the justices' ruling. I'm seeing opinions today that this is going to affect the tribal rights of these Native Americans in many more ways than beyond just the narrow ruling that this originally was, which was a criminal case against one man. How is it being interpreted there?
Hi, Judy. So I just want to state that what this ruling does is affirm what tribal citizens have known and upheld the law, the nation's highest law, is in that these treaties must be honored and that the nation, that the Muscogee Creek Nation's reservation was never dissolved. So in terms of what it's going to change, it's not really going to change anything. It already upholds what citizens of Oklahoma and citizens of the five tribes have already known.
So what about, in, just at the very basic level, what about in terms of criminal law? The fact that the man who had been convicted of child abuse, molesting a child, he had been tried in state court. Is his case or other cases now going to have to go back and be tried in federal courts?
It's my understanding that in terms of post-conviction relief, there are rules to follow and a timeline that also must be followed. This ruling doesn't change any of those procedural requirements. This notion that hundreds of people being released from prison is ridiculous. There's really no reporting or no basis in that. What it's going to do is it basically just reaffirms the Major Crimes Act, which is that when an Indian person commits a felony crime on reservation or Indian land, that person is subject to federal law, federal court, not state court.
And so the interpretation that we're seeing in some quarters, especially here in the press we're reading on the East Coast, in the New York Times and the Washington Post, that this is an historic landmark decision, you're saying it's really, the effect of it is going to be much more narrow than that.
I'm not disagreeing that it's not a landmark decision. It is a landmark decision. It's a historic decision in terms that it affirms tribal sovereignty. It upholds the law. It upholds the law that Indigenous people living in Oklahoma and elsewhere around the nation have already known. But in terms of affecting everyday life of citizens in Oklahoma, not Native and non, you know, well, a lot of the police departments, tribal police and state police, they already work together. Some of those officers are cross-deputized. So this thing that it's going to upend, you know, criminal proceedings, that's just not the case. In fact, yesterday, Oklahoma's Attorney General Mike Hunter and the five tribes released a statement saying that they were already working on an agreement after the Murphy case that was from the Supreme Court's last session. They were already starting to work on an agreement together to hammer out some of these jurisdictional and criminal prosecution issues that might arise. And I think the feeling on both from the tribes and from the state is that they already have a really good working relationship, and they're just going to keep continuing what they're doing. So again, this is just upholding the law that was already there and affirming tribal sovereignty.
Well, it certainly got our attention. Allison Herrera, WOSU, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lebanon recorded its highest one-day tally of coronavirus cases today after easing extended lockdowns. While nowhere near the U.S. surge, Lebanon can ill afford another crisis. It is already in economic freefall and has a paralyzed, corrupt, and bankrupt government. Meanwhile, hunger and despair are spreading. Special correspondent Jane Ferguson has this report.
Keeping a family fed and housed has rarely been harder in Lebanon. Parents like Susan Chaban, raising their kids in destitution, have no choice but to wait for help. Tripoli is the country's second largest city and long a neglected and poor area. The current economic freefall in Lebanon, with the government effectively bankrupt and a deep recession setting in, is swelling the ranks of the poor here. Half the country now live below the poverty line.
All my neighbors are the same. all of them, next to me and then next to them. My in-laws are the same. Here in Tripoli, life is very difficult. There are so many poor people here. Who is going to help us? They all are poor. They need help too.
Susan's husband used to find work occasionally as a car mechanic, but hasn't had a day's wages in many months. We met with the family on a hot day. The tiny room they live in was stifling. Outside, there's a food market, but few people around here can afford to buy. Instead, like Susan, more and more rely on charity. Civil society has long stepped into the space that Lebanon's government has left. There is no real safety net for people provided by the state. Instead, independent organizations like Sanabel Noor, funded by donations from within the community, hand out food and money to those who need it. Now, a huge portion of the country.
In Lebanon, the NGOs are the state, because we cannot rely at all on government. We have been working in this farm 20 years.
Several financial crises have hit the country at once. A devaluation of the currency, a banking sector near collapse, and a bankrupt government. In October 2019, vast protests hit the country, with people calling for political reform and an end to corrupt leadership. The protests, initially peaceful, turned violent as desperation rose. A nationwide lockdown since February due to the coronavirus ended much of the organized protests, but didn't stop recent rioting in Tripoli. Across the country, anger at the central and commercial banks is palpable. Since the end of the brutal 15-year civil war here in 1990, Lebanon has been attracting U.S. dollars by offering high interest rates at its banks. Those dollar deposits were then lent to the central bank, which gave them to the government. Now, the government is broke and owes the banks tens of billions of dollars, the people's money. As account holders panicked and tried to get their savings out, the banks started ad hoc capital controls. Very quickly, millions couldn't get to their own money. And yet, the ingrained corruption here has meant that since then, over $5 billion has been withdrawn anyway and is presumed to have left the country.
We're speaking about a country in crisis that doesn't have formal capital controls.
Nizar Ghanem is an economist based in Beirut.
We're in a financial crisis where the rich can take their money out and then come and bring it back again to buy public assets, while basically people who have pensions can't take their money out of the bank. This is full aggression against the poorest, most vulnerable segments of society.
Now, officials from the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, have arrived to discuss a bailout, the country's only real option. But Lebanon has seen bailouts before. Each time, little changes in the country's leadership, where traditional leaders of the numerous religious sects, Shia, Sunni, Druze, and Christian mainly, keep a tight grip on the economy. The sectarian political system keeps relative peace here, but entrenches corruption.
And these sects are, of course, presented by, if you would say, godfathers or dons or chiefs, we call them, right? Which means it's kind of ruled by an extended business networks that are more or less mafia-like.
The protest movement forced Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri to resign last year, but he and his party, much like the other sectarian leaders, still hold enormous power. The new government has managed to enact no real change since then. Sami Nader is a Lebanese political analyst.
The old political establishment has nominated newcomers, but they totally control the decision-making system. So it's the same old operating system.
That system includes the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah, now a powerful force in Lebanese politics and government. Most here expect IMF conditions on a bailout to include reforms that would threaten Hezbollah. It has much to lose from changes that seek to push back the influence of a group labeled by many member countries a terrorist organization.
I do believe that Hezbollah is short of option because on one hand he has the sanctions, on the other hand he feels the pressure of his political base, which is part of the Lebanese population that cannot take it anymore. The Lebanese economy is in a free fall. It's a free collapse.
The value of the Lebanese currency is collapsing too. Pegged to the dollar at 1500, The Lebanese lira has, at street exchangers, fallen to as much as 4,300 lira to the dollar in recent weeks. Most goods are imported, and for businesses, their real purchasing power is at the street rate.
Lebanese shoppers have seen huge price rises on supermarket shelves in recent months. If you have dollars, you can change them in the street to keep up with those prices. But most people are paid in the lira. And for them, for example, this box of cereal costs $20.
As the COVID-19 lockdown is slowly eased, protesters are coming back to the streets. Some warning that things could turn violent if politicians don't get serious about change.
From all over Lebanon, we came here to say, no, we will continue, the revolution will continue. And if you don't do your job as soon as possible, this would lead to a big chaos, because the Lebanese people, when they see there is no justice, the protesters will be obliged to use violence to take their rights back. And we go to the politicians' places and take our money back from them.
The country's banks are preparing for more anger, literally armor-plating themselves. And now, the strict coronavirus lockdowns of the last few months have pushed the economy over the edge. While those efforts to save lives have worked, Lebanon has had only 35 deaths from the virus. The people here will have to face incredible financial hardships for years to come. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson in Beirut, Lebanon.
As a number of states see spikes in coronavirus cases, Texas is breaking records. This week, the state set new highs for single-day deaths and the number of positive coronavirus tests. Texas Governor Greg Abbott warned that next week will be worse. Amna Nawaz spoke recently with Belinda Metz. She's a nurse manager of an all-COVID intensive care unit at Houston Methodist Hospital. She started by asking her about this latest spike in cases.
When we first locked down, people stayed at home. You didn't see people on the streets. You know, it was taken seriously, I feel like. And then as things began to open up, everybody maybe had a sigh of relief and said, great, we've got this. We've got this. And then we didn't. You know, I think when things open, it sends the message that everything's okay. It feels like people aren't taking it as seriously. And it's more serious now in Houston than it was before. We're more crowded now than, you know, in the hospitals than we were before.
Tell me what that looks like for you in terms of the supplies that you have, in terms of the patient, the bed capacity. What does that look like day to day?
We have plenty of masks and gowns and that type of thing. I think that what we're seeing now as far as what we need is we need more room. We need more beds. And fortunately, in the Texas Medical Center and at Houston Methodist, we have the ability to make more beds. You know, people to take care of those patients is a little challenging, but we are bringing on people from outside of the state, traveling nurses to support us.
Tell me a little bit more about the patient mix. Are they older? Are they younger?
I have a patient who's 88, and I have a patient who is 30. So it's really across the board. Many of the patients do have underlying illnesses such as diabetes or other lung diseases that make it specific, you know, and particularly hard with COVID. But we do sometimes have patients who have nothing. They've never been sick a day in their life. And for whatever reason, they haven't done well with the COVID.
So, Belinda, you've been doing this for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. Seems like it would take a lot to phase you. But in this moment, what is it that worries you about the virus and what you're seeing right now?
I mean, I feel like we have capacity right now, but I'm like, how many more patients are going to come? And are we going to keep having that capacity to care for these patients? Not necessarily in the form of a physical bed, but in the form of a nurse or a doctor. We feel, you know, we're starting to feel on the thinner side, and we know there's help on the way, but I just wonder where the end point is.
What's that like for you as a manager when you're in charge of all these people who are worried about getting sick themselves?
Yeah, well, I do worry about my employees, and we certainly have a fair number of our employees who are testing positive now, which also impacts the workforce. you know, I spend a lot of time out on the floor with my nurses and staff, just trying to encourage them and, you know, relieving their stress however, you know, I can. It's stressful because, you know, these patients cannot have families come and visit them. And so often the nurses do become their families. And sometimes it's, we have some sad moments with our patients, and that takes a toll too. When you go home, you, you're thankful for your family, you love your family, and you're just thankful for every moment you have.
If you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about anything in the community that you're serving right now, what would it be?
Well, one, I wish everybody would wear a face mask when they go out. I do. It's hard for me because we know that with two people who have masks on, that the incidence of transmissions go down considerably. I guess I don't understand why people don't want to protect each other and protect themselves, especially in the face of everything that's happening. And I just feel like, you know, you got to help us out. We want to help I want to help all patients, but got to help us out. We got to decrease the admissions that are coming in through our doors right now. And if that's the way to do it, I don't understand why people don't want to do that.
Do you think that people don't believe that it's not as bad as it is because they're not seeing what you see every day?
I want to say, come to work with me. Come on, let's go. Come see what I see every day and see how that affects your attitude about what COVID is and what's happening to people. People say it's no worse than the flu. Well, for some people, it might not be any worse than the flu, but for many others, they're losing their lives to it and they're dying alone. And I hate it when I hear people say, oh, it's only a 2 or 3% mortality. Well, it's only 2 or 3% until it's your 2 or 3% and your family.
When you see the way the cases are rising right now, how are you preparing for what's ahead? How do you go home at the end of the day and get ready for what's the next 14, 16 hour day?
You know, a lot of my nurses are chronologically very young. And so I stress to them that this is a pandemic. It's hard to plan for a pandemic. And it's hard for me to tell you exactly how your day is going to go every day. But we became nurses for a reason. And we need to rise to the occasion and we need to meet the needs of the patients.
Well, we wish you all the luck and good safety and good health in the weeks and the months ahead. That's Belinda Metz, nurse manager at Houston Methodist Hospital in Texas. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And now for their take on this week in politics, we turn to Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart. Mark Shields is away. So hello to both of you. Let's start with the coronavirus, David, as we just heard in Amna's conversation with the head nurse there in Houston. These cases are surging. Some hospitals are having difficulty. We are seeing cities set new records across the South and the West. But President Trump says things are going well, that he expects things to get better in just a couple of weeks. He's now insisting the schools open in the fall. What do you make of the president's approach?
Well, this is just a tough disease. Why is it rising in California and Florida with totally different lockdown rules? It's rising in countries that seem to have been doing well. I think epidemiologists are now humbled by what a complicated and tough disease this is. It's just not a help that Donald Trump is detached from all that, detached from the reality of the disease, detached from Anthony Fauci. He hasn't spoken to really the best person in America to talk about this. He hasn't spoken to that guy for 2 months, it turns out. And so he's living in a different world, which would be bad enough, but he's polarized the country, successfully polarized the country. A few weeks ago, I was on the program, maybe a couple months ago, talking about all the bipartisanship there was. There was a lot of, back in March and April, people were reacting not as Republicans and Democrats, but as one. You got these 77% majorities. That's really not the case as much anymore. We have the president and Fox and the polarization industry has successfully turned this into a left-right thing, which is just crazy. It's a disease.
And Jonathan, I mean, it is the case the president is now criticizing Dr. Fauci, and he's insisting the schools open. He's threatening to withhold federal money from the schools.
Yes, which when you have a global pandemic that is
spiking all over the country in most of the states. And then you have the president of the United States, who's, David was saying, is not following his own guidelines for helping to keep the pandemic in check. The idea that we are talking about opening schools and forcing schools to open when there's no national strategy, no vaccine, and, you know, 50 different ways of going about trying to tamp down the pandemic strikes me. And I'm not a parent, and I understand that parents are concerned about their children's education, but sending children to schools in the middle of a pandemic with no national strategy, I think, is worrisome.
And David, there are arguments to be made. Surely children need to be in school. The American Academy of Pediatrics made that case this week. But you combine that with what you mentioned a minute ago, the president now criticizing the man who's arguably the most trusted person in the country when it comes to this disease, to COVID, Dr. Fauci. Is there a strategy there that you see that in some way is going to benefit the president?
Well, I don't think it's going to benefit. If you look at his polling back in when this started, at least the lockdown started in March, he had at one point reached a spot where he was 55% of Americans approved of his COVID handling. Now it's down to 33%, and those numbers have really plummeted in the last 2 weeks or so as reality has dawned on Americans that we're losing to this virus. And America is not fooled by what's going on. Donald Trump, and they know Donald Trump is out of touch. Opening the school strikes me as the classic problem that should, A, be settled in some sort of subtle way by people who know what they're talking about. And maybe in some places you can open the schools and maybe you can't. Politics is about competing goods. And competing goods are getting kids educated, getting parents some relief, and keeping them safe. And so it should be possible in local areas, in New York, maybe where the disease is not so good, or is not so high, to strike some sort of workable way to do this. But having an all or nothing and forcing schools to do stuff strikes me as insane.
And Jonathan, what you're both getting at, I mean, this idea of rejecting the CDC guidance on schools, of criticism of Dr. Fauci, rejecting science, is the president taking a risk by doing that?
Oh, absolutely. The president going up against Dr. Fauci that's a fool's errand. Dr. Fauci is a world-renowned, world-respected scientist. He has been in that job for multiple decades. He knows what he's talking about. And if the president were cognizant and capable of ceding authority to someone, he would allow Dr. Fauci to go out there, tell the American people on a daily basis, here's where we are with the pandemic, here's what we need to do, here's what you can do to protect yourself, your neighbors, and your families. And if we do this together, we can overcome this. It's going to take some sacrifice, but it's worth it in the short term for the long-term benefits. We don't have that. What we have is a president, as David said, is living in his own reality when it comes to the pandemic, trying to wish it away, happy talk it away. But as we see with the rising cases of coronavirus and the rising death rates in a whole lot of states around the country, the American people on the ground in those states are bumping up against the reality, a reality that the president of the United States refuses to see.
Separately, David, the president got bad news and good news, I guess you could say, in split decisions by the Supreme Court this week, cases wherein there was an effort to gain access to the president's personal financial records. The court ruling the president has no absolute immunity from prosecution, as his lawyers had argued. Does the office of the presidency come away changed? And what about the effect on this president himself by these rulings?
Well, there won't be much effect on President Trump because he'll litigate this at lower courts and we will not see tax records before the election. I think it's important to establish that the president does have to reveal tax records, and whether that's done at the Supreme Court or through legislation, which is being talked about, that's a good precedent. It does strike me that for a conservative court, this has been a pretty bad month for the president. John Roberts again and again has said it's not only this is an administration that doesn't do things correctly. And he slapped them down repeatedly for not doing things correctly on abortion, on a whole series of rulings, a religious liberty. Conservatives have no reason to be happy with last month of the court. It's striking to me that this is the case.
What do you make of it, Jonathan? I mean, it was John Roberts who wrote these decisions, and it was the two justices President Trump appointed, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, who voted against the president on this case involving the Manhattan DA.
Well, what this tells me is that those justices sided with the rule of law and sided with the Constitution. The president, when he talks about the Supreme Court, and particularly his two appointees to the court, he talks about them as if, you know, he owns them, that because he put them on the court, that they will side with him no matter what the case is. As long as he's for it, they're going to be for it. And what we saw with all of these decisions, I'm glad that David brought that up, the president's been smacked around by the Supreme Court in their rulings. And what, especially with the cases, the rulings that were handed down yesterday, the court is saying our fealty is not to the president, our fealty is to the Constitution. And the Constitution says that the laws apply to every man, and that man also includes the president of the United States. And so for a president who thinks that the world revolves around him, that people work for him, literally work for him, the ruling says, no, we don't work for you. We are here, we've taken an oath to the Constitution, not to you.
I want to bring both of you back to the other fellow who's running for president this November, Joe Biden. This week, David, he and I guess they were calling it a task force, the Biden camp and Bernie Sanders were looking at ways they could put together an agenda that would be acceptable to the folks who support Bernie Sanders. What do you make of this? It's a look at some of the things that Joe Biden says he wants to do if he's elected president. I mean, is this the kind of progressive agenda that's going to appeal to those fervent Bernie Sanders supporters?
Yeah, I would say this: the Sanders-Biden reconciliation has been made easier by the fact that we're in a depression or a severe economic recession, and so there's a lot of room for government action. And I would say Biden has made some concessions to the left, I guess you want to call it that, but he hasn't done anything that would scare away voters like Medicare for All or anything like that. What's really striking to me is in his economic announcements this week is that he's talking like Donald Trump. He's got a populist rhetoric of America First, and it's a different version of America First, but this is not Bill Clinton or, frankly, Barack Obama's Democratic Party anymore, which was a free trade party and a more open party. This is we have to secure our own supply chain. We have to move away from China. We have to close in and serve America First. And so this is looks like Dick Gephardt, if people remember Dick Gephardt. This was the Democratic Party he tried to lead us toward decades ago, and the economic populism is here.
I remember him well. And Jonathan Capehart, in rolling this out yesterday, Joe Biden's talking about buy American first, support American workers. President Trump reacted and said he's plagiarized. He's taking my ideas away from me. He's copying me.
Which is rather interesting, because I didn't think that that President Trump was a progressive, that President Trump was someone who was looking and getting his ideas from the left. The idea that President Trump and Bernie Sanders have something in common is actually kind of laughable. But what's interesting here is, and I agree with David, that sure, both Vice President Biden and President Trump have both have an America First agenda, but they're coming at it from different ways. And I think that President Trump comes at his America First agenda from a very dark place, from a place where it's, you know, America turning its back not only on the world, but in a lot of ways on its ideals. Whereas I think Vice President Biden, and in his plan, what he is trying to say is, we are in a mess, we are in a global pandemic, our economy has imploded, the pandemic has shown that there are issues with our supply chain that also have an impact on how healthcare is delivered, which you could also make an argument is a national security issue. But the overall thing that I take away from what Vice President Biden put out yesterday, and that he will be putting out over the days and weeks ahead, is he has an agenda for where he wants to lead the country. He is giving a rationale to voters for why they should vote for him and have him lead the country for the next over the next 4 years. When President Trump was asked that same question in an interview a few days ago, he could not give a forward-looking answer.
Well, it's a reminder there is an election underway. It's easy to forget sometimes because there's a whole lot else going on. But it's a reminder, and we want to thank both of you, David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
There has been considerable conversation in this country about the taking down of Confederate statues, and there are many more debates brewing over the messages other memorials and statues send and how many people and how people may perceive them differently. In the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Washington, D.C., stands the Emancipation Memorial, which has been a flashpoint in recent weeks. Jeffrey Brown talked to four Black Americans on their varied views on it. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
A hot afternoon in Washington, D.C.
I am reminded every single day that I am less than of a white person, whether I want to admit it or not.
A heated exchange over a statue of Abraham Lincoln standing above a kneeling, newly freed African-American man. Last month, protesters gathered to demand the statue be taken down. The National Park Service, which oversees the site, erected a fence as protection.
This statue represents the oppression of Black people.
20-year-old Harvard University student Glenn Foster helped organize the call to take down the statue. He sees one man shirtless with broken shackles at the feet of another man in a position of power.
How are you going to represent Black people looking free when you have them kneeling before a white man? What imagery does that teach our young children about our history? And what does it teach them moving forward in terms of achieving their liberation and freedom on their own terms? A lot of older people believe that the statue was fine because of the context of where they've learned why it came to be, instead of understanding the imagery of what it stands for.
Set in Lincoln Park, the bronze statue called the Emancipation or Freedmen's Memorial dates to 1876. It was intended to honor the slain president and commemorate the Emancipation Proclamation, the document signed by Lincoln to end slavery in the Confederacy.
But let's not negate what happened. You need physical evidence that proves what happened, that we don't know how to go back to it again. That is my story.
And even now, instead of a symbol of subservience, Marsha Cole sees one of liberation.
I see an African-American male figure on one knee, and he's in the process of rising. His head was up. He was looking forward to a life of freedom, and that's what I saw.
At the recent protest, Cole picked up a bullhorn, debated with activists, and made her case for keeping the statue. For her, there's more to the story. She studied and reenacts the life of Charlotte Scott, a freed African-American woman who raised funds to build the memorial after Lincoln's assassination.
She could be my one of my direct ancestors. So I want people to know that there were individuals who have individual stories.
And for you, that story, her story, is intrinsically tied to the statue, and therefore keep the statue.
Exactly. It honors her generosity of heart. I would like to see it remain as a teaching moment. Without artifacts, visual artifacts, people tend to forget. And this statue there, while it may provoke some discomfort, discomfort is good because then it would inspire inquiry.
The complications and complexities were there from the start. A memorial paid for by Blacks, but designed by a white sculptor, Thomas Ball, in a process controlled by a white-run organization. The famed abolitionist and orator Frederick Douglass delivered an historic speech at the 1876 dedication, but also took the opportunity to point to Lincoln's shortcomings. And now those complexities have burst anew as the nation confronts the continuing racism of today and the legacy it was built upon.
It's not Lincoln that's at issue. I'm fine with us memorializing him. He was a monumental president. but it's this depiction specifically that's the issue.
Last month, 30-year-old Marcus Goodwin, a Washington, D.C. real estate businessman and now candidate for the D.C. Council, climbed atop the memorial, a public contrast to the kneeling man below. He then launched a petition drive to remove and relocate the statue.
There's no such thing as erasing the past. My solution is to bring this into a museum where it can be properly contextualized, where a docent can walk you through and tell you the history and the intentionality behind the art, because it doesn't achieve its intended goal. People see it, they see demeaning imagery, and maybe it's a generational divide, but we don't see the type of fair and equitable representation that's inherent in the American dream.
If you take down or change the symbols or the monuments, is that not changing the past in some way?
No, in fact, you're changing the future, and you're doing it for the better, I would say.
Goodwin says he got the idea of relocating the statue after seeing reports of a similar demand in Boston, home to a replica of the same monument. And in recent days, the Boston Art Commission voted unanimously to take it down, without yet deciding where it should go. It's a debate, says Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie Bunch, with many layers.
It is about history, but it's about who we are as a nation and who we want to be going forward.
One of the nation's preeminent historians, Bunch was also founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. He told us he's for keeping the Emancipation Memorial, but perhaps adding another statue next to it, of Frederick Douglass, for example, creating, in a sense, more history.
What I want to see is a reasoned process that allows us to discuss, that allows us to bring history before we make decisions of pulling things down. I think that, yes, we could take that statue down. We could replace it with a statue that just talks about the enslaved. And I think that what we do is, while on the one hand, we enrich our understanding, on the other hand, I think we lose the opportunity to help people understand more about Lincoln and who he was and what he did.
Bunch thinks these memorials will have to be considered case by case. Local decisions by commissions that move with care, but relatively quickly. Does that surprise you how kind of deep this has gone?
It has surprised me both how deep it's gone and how rapid it's gone. Because the challenge is, the statue itself doesn't give us any sense of complexity, nuance, or ambiguity. But that's what history does.
That may be a lot to ask in an America so greatly divided, seemingly not in a mood for complexity and nuance. Now fighting over its past and future, one statue at a time. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
As we've been discussing tonight, the coronavirus continues to exact a devastating toll on families and communities across the country. Again, we take a moment tonight to remember some of the lives lost. Oscar Rosa was the go-to for friends and family seeking advice, homework help, or a favor. Everything he did was to support his family, especially his niece, Amory. Bright and dedicated, Oscar excelled in debate as a captain and a coach in his Los Angeles high school and later in college. He would often mentor students on opposing teams. His family said he wanted everyone to learn and love debate like he did. Oscar was just 25. For nearly three decades, John Walter offered laughs and life lessons to his parish youth group in Queens, New York. As one former student put it, he took a bunch of misfits and turned us into family. A long-suffering Mets fan and lifelong New Yorker, his son Brian said John was always the funniest person in the room. He was fiercely devoted to his wife of 57 years, Peg. Their four children and two grandsons. The family proudly marched in the city's annual Autism Speaks Walk in support of his grandson, James. John was 80 years old. Van A. Sykes believed in the potential of all formerly incarcerated women and co-founded a halfway house in the Bronx to help them re-enter society and find jobs. It was an idea sprouted during her own time behind bars. Van A spent nearly 4 years in federal prison after pleading guilty to a scheme to steal food stamps. During that time, Van A's husband of 2 decades, James, passed away. But she spoke to their 3 children, Jeffrey, James Jr., and Alexis, every day. Van A was 53 years old. Raul Guali Jr. was at his happiest when he was spending time with his 3 girls. When Raul was in high school, he became a single father. That experience propelled him to study nursing and go on to work at an assisted living facility on Long Island. He met his wife, Marissa, and their family grew. They did everything together, from family vacations to Disney, to food shopping and laundry. Raul was 34 years old. Victor Arzola's convenience store in Juarez, Mexico, was a neighborhood safe haven with a self-designed loan system to help customers who couldn't pay. Victor's wife of 68 years, Belém, was the love of his life. After she became ill in 2007, he dedicated himself to her care, settling down in Colorado. Rarely seen without his big cowboy hat and a smile, Victor became a U.S. citizen at 87 years old. His family said it was his happiest accomplishment. Victor was 93. As we've seen, COVID-19 is taking a heavy toll, and many are not able to say goodbye to their loved ones. It leaves some of us unsure we can find the right words for those who are grieving. Throughout life, we are told to avoid cliches, but writer Rion Amilcar Scott shares his humble opinion on the one place the cliche will do.
On the day before she died, the last time I saw my mother lucid, for no good reason, I neglected to kiss her goodbye when I left the hospital for the night. And that's how I missed the final opportunity to kiss the cheek of my still living and conscious mother. This is one of the many sadnesses that frequently swarm my grieving mind, things I would rather not think about. Likewise, I'd rather not think of things to tell my mother next time we talk, only to remember there won't be a next time. But hey, all mothers die. She's supposed to go and leave me here with only memories. It's the proper way of things. In the presence of the grieving, some people choose to say nothing. Ashamedly, I've done it myself, even after knowing better. But I've learned now the one good use for cliches. They somehow find power as a balm to spread over the pain. Look, as a writer, all my training has taught me to be allergic to cliches. If I were to somehow write that my mother's death caused me to cry my eyes out, in revision, I would perhaps replace that stock phrase with a description of words lost in the crack of a voice trying to stifle back tears. Death in all its devastating finality, though, won't wait for a revision. Death won't wait for you to dig through your soul in search of a blazing truth that will put a grieving spirit in order. I'm not convinced such a sequence of words even exists. When someone dies, look the grieving in their eye and say, "My condolences," or "I'm sorry for your loss." Say it sincerely and with meaning. When those words were said to me in the days after my mother's passing, it said, "I see you and I see your grief." There may not be a blinding truth within you about anyone's loss, but there are small sparkles of light. The power your cliches have in the face of death's enormity is their acknowledgement that there is nothing to say. No words as that particular cliche goes, but still something needs to be said to recognize both the devastation and the humanity of the griever. Those well-worn words are a small offering, perhaps, but they'll suffice.
Rion Amilcar Scott, we thank you. And on the NewsHour online right now, we look at how LGBTQ artists and activists are using zines, short magazines, to tell their own stories and to preserve their history. That's all on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And we'll be back right here on Monday with a look at how historic Alexandria, Virginia, is trying to balance safety with the needs of local businesses. That's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe. Good night.